Welcome to Beyond90Seconds.com, where the aim is to delve a bit deeper into news stories, deeper than the time allotted for a typical TV story anyway. Start to finish, that's usually around 90 seconds, give or take. I'm your host of Beyond90Seconds.com, Mark Horner. New bumper music this time around, courtesy of the Tucson band Wound Too Tight. I met their lead singer, Scott Hamilton, while reporting on a story for K-Gun 9 in Tucson about 6 weeks ago. Hamilton eventually told me he was in a band, went to high school in the 70s, and grew up listening to a lot of what you'd call classic rock these days. Well, that kicked off a discussion about music that I think went longer than the news interview that day. The name of this song, Pay the Price. Some say a convicted killer is not having to pay the price, thanks to a Washington State Supreme Court ruling called the Andrus Decision. One thing we know for certain, that killer says he's moving to Arizona.
To me, if he moved around the corner or if he moved to Arizona, it doesn't matter to me. He's still, in my mind, a huge danger to the community, and he needs to be watched, and people need to be aware of him. He doesn't deserve to be anonymous. He needs to be labeled as a dangerous man, and I don't care where he is.
That's 52-year-old Scott Stubberfield, a Seattle-area school teacher. His mother, Frances Stubberfield, was murdered in 1977, 2 days after Thanksgiving. The killer, a man named Ross Reniker, was caught passed out with the body. He was reportedly covered in blood. Reniker already had a violent history. And get this, since the time of his conviction for second-degree murder in the Stubberfield case, Reniker has reportedly tried to have phone sex with his 12-year-old stepdaughter. So, how did a man who seemed destined to die in prison get out? And why isn't he having to report to anyone? And why aren't his new, unsuspecting neighbors apparently going to be warned about his background? The answer to these questions and more all revealed in my conversation with Scott Stubberfield. We spoke by telephone Monday evening, January 21st, 2008. We began by speaking about what his mother, Frances Stubberfield, was doing 2 days before her murder. It was Thanksgiving Day, 1977.
She volunteered to serve meals to homeless people instead of like cooking a traditional Thanksgiving dinner for my brother and sister and I. She said, you know, I'd rather just go down and help others serve meals. And so, ironically, just one of the last things she did before she was murdered was serving meals to the homeless.
Is this pretty typical of your mother as you knew her?
Very typical, yeah. She was, you know, in the 60s when I was growing up, she would work with, like, kindergarten kids that are with poverty. And, you know, she was always involved with community things and just that kind of person, you know, just unassuming, helping others, never wanted to be recognized for anything.
2 days after that moment at the homeless shelter, she's at a restaurant in White Center. Now, I grew up in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah.
I don't know about back then, but I think White Center could be kind of a tough area. Is that a fair description?
Well, it was funny because, yeah, we lived in West Seattle. And she was single at the time, and she was invited by a friend to go to a singles dance, and it was at a community center over in White Center, and she didn't want to go, but her friend pestered her, and she said, okay, I'll go. And her friend had a boyfriend, and they went to this dance, and it ended around midnight, and she was invited by her friend and her boyfriend to go a couple blocks it wasn't a Denny's, but it was like a pancake house that was open late at night, and her friend invited her to come over with them to have a meal before they went home. And the bad thing that happened was that her friend and her boyfriend left before my mom, and they were in the restaurant waiting for her when she parked her car into the parking lot, and that's when Reniker came out of the restaurant and abducted her.
This is the very, very sad moment, of course, in this case, because
Right.
there Reniker was actually living in Yakima at the time, according to the article I've read,
Right.
and he's pursuing an old girlfriend or an ex-girlfriend in that area. The cops are
Yeah.
called, and they basically tell him, "Hey, go to the restaurant and let it the alcohol's hanging on you. Let it wear off before
Yeah.
you go anywhere." Is that what happened here?
Well, the girlfriend knew him, knew Reniker, and so when he arrived at her house, drunk and her started harassing her, she called the police, and two policemen showed up, and Reniker talked them into. Of course, in the 70s, these things were much more un. It was much more uncommon to have this serious of an crimes as much as they are today. But anyway, the cops, Reniker talked them into letting him off at the restaurant to drink some coffee and sober up. And the cops did. They just dropped him off there and went on their way.
So it's
So he
at
was in there when he was. So that's what the setup was. He was in there drinking coffee or whatever, and he walked out right when my mom was parking her car, and he had his opportunity.
Now, for years, it sounds as if he was insisting, even though he'd been caught red-handed, so to speak.
Right.
Well, first of all, let's take it one step at a time.
Yeah.
Your mom goes missing.
Right.
Now, you must have been about 21 years old at this time.
Yeah, I was 22.
Are you living at home at that time?
I was married for three, just newlywed for 3 months, and my wife and I were living in, maybe 20 minutes away from my mom's house.
How much time passes before you realize that mom never came home last night?
Probably 24 hours, because we had a pre-date before her Thanksgiving. Before Thanksgiving of that year, we had a date with her to come over to that Sunday after Thanksgiving to have dinner at her house. So my wife and I arrived in the afternoon, like 3 in the afternoon of the Sunday, and the paper was on the porch. Sunday paper was on the porch, and her car was gone. And I kind of thought that was kind of weird. So we came in the house, and she had a roast thawing on the counter, and the roast was like dripping onto the kitchen floor. And I said, "Well, that's been out for a long time, and so something's wrong." So I called her girlfriend, the one that she went to the dance with, and I asked her. I said, "Do you know anything about where my mom might be?" And she says, "Well, we invited her to come and have a meal after the dance, but she never showed up, so we just assumed that she went home." And I knew something was wrong there, so I really didn't know what to do, because in those days, calling the cops really didn't do anything, because they needed, like, the person had to be missing for a long time before they would even start looking around. So about an hour later, after calling my brother and my sister and trying to call some other her friends, the couple of detectives came to the door and told us that her body was found in Yakima. So everything happened very quickly.
Now, Reniker is found in the car with your mother's body, and would this have been your mother's car?
Yes.
And was it was actually just east of Yakima. Was it like Union Gap, maybe, or?
You know, I don't know Yakima that well, but the reporter that I talked to from Yakima said it's somewhere right over by the river, by the free that where there's now a freeway. So it sounds like it's like pretty well known area.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Reniker is in the car with your mother's body when he's found by police?
Right, yeah. Well, that's where he had a lot of he screwed up a lot of the whole thing. He went over there. He made my mom drive over to Yakima and then drove her to a remote area with the intent. He finally admitted with the intent to rape her, and she put up a fight, and he ended up strangling. She had a scarf on. He ended up strangling her and then beating her, killed her with a rock, a large rock. And then he went back to his old neighborhood because his family was there and tried to find somebody that would help him dispose of her body. And finally he found one of his old buddies that would agree to do it. And when his friend and Reniker arrived back to the scene, I guess he used my mom's car to go find somebody. My mom's body's laying in the ground there somewhere. The friend of Reniker's freaked out and took off. Reniker ended up being passed. He passed out drunk in the car because the car was like stuck in the mud. And the accomplice guy phoned the police because he was scared. And then the cops arrived to the scene, and he was passed out. And my mom was in the back seat, and he was covered with blood and everything. we lucked out on the fact that he passed out because there was some time that passed before the cops arrived to the scene and found him. That helped us a lot by his buddy calling the cops, and, you know, it was pretty well a done deal by then.
Your mom put up a fight. Sounds like your mom was never raped.
He killed her before the rape, after she refused to be raped, and then it was all over.
Okay. Yeah. Backing up, that trip over the pass to Yakima, your mom was behind the wheel.
Right.
Do I understand correctly that the vehicle was actually stopped for some sort of traffic infraction?
Yeah, she was driving, and she was one of these type of people, if you imagine a single woman at 52 years old driving over the pass, and it's like now, there's a lot of snow, a lot of ice, and it was pitch black, dark, and she would be petrified to go over there by herself right now, but she had her high beam headlights on, and she refused to dim them, I guess, when the state patrol went by, and he turned around and stopped her, and Reniker admitted finally that he had her so scared. One of the things he told her was that I'm going to kill you and the state patrol officer if you do anything. And one of the things that we think that she did was, you know, he also told her that if you just get me to Yakima, I'll let you go. And I think even though she probably didn't believe that, she didn't do anything because she didn't want the state patrol officer killed. She thought he would get killed, and she kind of just, you know, took it on. And Reniker did admit that she was just petrified, terrified to death to even, like, move. You know, she was frozen.
I wonder if that state patrol officer knows that, for lack of a better term, your mom took the bullet, so to speak, fearing that.
Yeah, he did. He was part of the Reniker plea bargain. I mean, he admitted guilt, and so there was no jury trial the first time, but the state patrol officer was interviewed by the prosecutors, and he just could not believe that, you know, it was unfortunate because it haunted him for the rest of his life, and I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he admitted it was just something he never got over. That was something we never. We kind of knew that, knowing her so well, that she was two things, petrified and willing to, she was that, I just believe it, that she was willing to take the bullet, like you say, for the state patrol, even though Reniker was, you know, just a manipulative type guy that was just trying to play a game to get over there.
Now, for years, according to the article out of Yakima, Reniker denied abducting your mother and claimed that she'd agreed to give him a ride back to Yakima.
Right. He agreed for years that they met to have drinks, and then she agreed to drive him back. See, the big thing about that was the restaurant that they were at, and there was no alcohol there. There was, you know, it was a pancake house, so that was a really obvious, you know, non-believable part of his story. Because they went right from there to Yakima.
Okay. Well, let's push it forward a little bit. He pleads, as you mentioned, there was no jury trial, but he pleads to second-degree murder, felony murder, right?
Right.
And at the time, there's a maximum sentence of 20 years?
Yeah, it was 20, since his record was so bad already, it was 20. He was sentenced for 20 years to life because he would be, at that time, he was under the review board. We have a review board in the state of Washington that would review his case every once in a while, and then, but he was, his minimum was 20 years.
And when was this plea deal made? Was it in 78?
So she was murdered in November of 77. So it was probably February or early 78.
Okay. And as you mentioned, this Intermediate Sentencing Review Board, you must feel pretty good about its role over, you know, these past three decades, because they have a good grasp on what they feel Mr. Reniker, and certainly what you feel Mr. Reniker is all about in terms of a danger. And they kind of have this option card that they can play. They, much like a parole board, can say, no, buddy, you're not going anywhere yet.
Yes, and that was a really good thing for us, because from 78 until like 1993, my family and I, we had no information. I mean, it was set up in our state where even when he came up for parole review by the board, we never got any information. And so there's a group in the state of Washington called friends and families of violent crime victims that went to the state legislature and said, you know, victims' families have a right to know what's going on with these felons that have killed their family members. And so we were notified in like 1994 that we did have the right now to go down to Olympia and meet with the review board after each one of his parole reviews and give our side of the story and also receive information of what he was doing behind bars. So that was a big step forward for us. So for the last 12 years, I've met with the review board every time he's come up for a review.
And the opportunity to learn about what Mr. Reniker has been up to, that proves very valuable and insightful to you, because you're hearing from this sentencing review board that Mr. Reniker doesn't seem like he's a prime candidate for rehabilitation.
No. Yes. You know, it was really good, because they would actually, you know, they would set up a day and time to meet with the felons. And for years and years and years, he would not even meet with them. So they would just take information from the authorities at the facility he was at, because he had, one of the other things we realized over the years, but he was being moved from facility to facility, and I can't remember all the reasons. But he was not meeting with them, and then he was violating some of his things in prison, and he was also not taking, he was supposed to take sexual predator court classes and drugs and alcohol classes, all the classes and things to help him show that he wanted to be rehabilitated, he was refusing to do. So those were all good signs for us that he was continuing not to be parolable.
What tells you, if you don't mind sharing some specifics, what tells you that Mr. Reniker quite potentially remains a sexual predator at the very least?
His record is terribly long. I mean, he at 14 years old, he was with two other guys. He committed an armed robbery, and he raped a 17-year-old woman that was held hostage during that crime. And then he, since that time, he's only been out in public in the community for less than a year in the last 47 years. So his pattern was he would commit a crime, serve his time, 2 to 3 years, whatever, get out for a couple months, recommit a crime, another armed robbery, another a car theft, a burglary, a rape, and then keep going. So he had a real pattern, and he was only out for 2 months or so when he murdered my mother. So, and then he had continued to have sexual deviancy things inside prison by, for some strange reason, he's been married 5 times, and I don't know anything about how that can happen, but one of his wife's daughters, which was Reniker's stepdaughter, on 2 occasions when they were visiting him in prison, one time he was caught fondling, she was 12 years old at the time, he was fondling her, and then another time over the phone when he was talking to her, he was trying to solicit phone sex with her. So his sexual deviancy continued behind bars. Even, you know, so he had a real pattern there.
I'm trying to understand the first incident where apparently I presume the 12-year-old daughter is there with her mother.
And, you know, I don't know. The parole board, I'm sure, would have the details on that, and I probably was told over the years, but I really don't remember, because you're right, those are supervised visits.
Yeah, very strange.
Very strange.
Well, okay. So anyway, you come to terms in time to a large extent with your mother's death. You can find some solace, some satisfaction, it seems, as time goes on, and knowing that it appears Reniker is going nowhere. Then, lo and behold, 6 years ago, you have the Andrus decision,
right,
which invalidated hundreds, if I understand correctly, hundreds of murders. Murder convictions in Washington State.
Right.
Ultimately, they take a good long look at your mother's case.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was just looking at it today. Reniker, I'm sure either he, under some advice from somebody, he petitioned to fall under the Andrus decision because he felt, or whoever advised him felt, that he could get a resentencing under the new decision. And so he petitioned for that, and he received that, even though the parole board continually found him. You know, the parole board also talked to doctors or or prosecutors, or the original sentencing, it was highly recommended by the judge and the prosecutors that with his previous criminal record, never, in their mind, he should never be let free out in the public again. But the Andrus decision was so shocking to us as a family that these guys could be even reconsidered for resentencing to the point where they could be released. It was just unbelievable to us. So he did petition for it, and he qualified after review by the whoever reviews it.
That's right. They made it retroactive. Yeah.
They did. You know what happened was, because it was such an outrageous decision, the general public and some of the organizations mobilized and said, you know, this is not going to happen. I mean, this cannot continue to happen. And so the state Supreme Court didn't change their decision, but the state legislature said, okay, from 2004 or whatever the date was, the decision was made in 2002, and then a couple of years of fighting back and forth went by. And then by 2004, the state legislature said, okay, from this date forward, we're going to go back to what it was. They can add felony assault to second-degree murder. But for some crazy reason, they couldn't go back to anybody from there to back to like 76 when that window of guys from 1978, I think it was 1978 to 2003, all still have the right to be resentenced if they qualify, and there's hundreds of them still out there waiting to be resentenced.
Yeah, you have to wonder how feasible it is for the courts to even try and pull this off.
Well, you know, that's one thing that I don't think about very much is how many millions of dollars it's costing the taxpayers to resentence these guys. Because my mother, I mean, Reneker, the prosecutors from Yakima called me and said, you know, bad news, but your Reneker is going to be resentenced. Or not resentenced, but there's a possibility we can have a jury trial. But see, what happened was it was 28 years later, so the evidence and some of the key witnesses and some of the main players of the prosecutor side were either dead or they couldn't find them or anything. So having a jury trial was hard for them to do because of such a weak case they would have. So they almost had to go. They were kind of asking my family for permission to just go ahead and do a plea bargain because that's kind of the only choice they had. So that hurt us on the fact that so many years went by. Reneker, you know, it was an advantage to him.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, the state of Washington seems, aside from the Supreme Court, there seems to be a lot of concern about letting Mr. Reneker out, so much so that the Attorney General's office says, let's have him evaluated as a possible sexual predator. But that came up empty.
That did come up negative, yeah. He didn't qualify. Mm. So he's apparently, well, you know, the date was officially yesterday, and I don't know if he's been released yet due to whatever they have to do, but he is free to go with no supervision, nothing. See, if he would have been released, under the review board, at least he would have it was a step-by-step process to be back into society. So at first he would be in like a halfway house, and then he'd be under supervision by a parole officer, and then he would this, and then he would that. With this ruling, he's free to go with no supervision. So, and he says he's moving to Arizona, and I have no clue if that's what he's going to do or not.
How do you know that he says he's going to go to Arizona?
Well, at his retrial, my wife and I and my sister, we got to make a statement before the judge, and then Reneker was able to make a statement before the judge. And one of the things that's really been disappointing to me is that a few years ago when I was meeting with the review board, it's probably been 5 years ago, 4 years ago, they said Reneker had developed cancer, and it was lung cancer, and it was all cancer in his body, and he was receiving treatments, and the doctors told the review board people saying, well, you know, the outlook looks pretty grim. So I said, okay, I thought, okay, good, he's going to die of cancer, this whole thing will be over. And here we are in 2007, and he said in the court, he says, you know, with my cancer problems and whatever, I just want to move to Arizona with my wife and die where it's warmer because it's better for my health or something. So he did mention at his resentencing that he wanted to move to Arizona.
Is that what they called it, was a resentencing in 2007? And what
you know, I don't know. You know, I call it that, but I don't know if that's the official word. To
Okay.
me, it's since his original second degree felony assault was thrown out, it was now second degree, whatever it was. It was a lesser crime that they sentenced him for. And since he did the minimum already for his original sentence, this lesser crime, the judges said, he's up for review in a couple of years. I'm just going to set a release date for those, because this was in September of 2005. She said, okay, he's up for parole in January of 2007. I'll just make a release date for that date. And that was the end of that.
So Reneker tells the judge, the court, that he wants to fade off into the sunset in Arizona.
Yeah.
Do you still consider the man a threat to others?
I do. One of my main parts of my statement to the judge is I consider him a serious threat to the community and his pattern of his history of starting as a teenager as a rapist and a armed robber, now a murderer. I do fear that he could easily harm somebody else. And I don't know wherever he is. I mean, I'll have no clue, but I do consider him a threat. I don't know. I've never sat down and talked to him. In the courtroom, I'll tell you, in 2005, for a guy full of cancer, he still looked pretty healthy, and he's a big man. He's like 6'2", big, you know, he's a big guy. So to me, he didn't look like he was dying of cancer, but I consider him a very dangerous person.
What would you tell the people of Arizona if, in fact, he does come here?
I think it would be, if the authorities, it's kind of like a sexual a pedophile or something. If they knew where he lived, and somehow keep tabs on him, and somehow, because we just had two recent cases up here in Washington where a young couple was murdered by a guy released out of Massachusetts. He's similar to Reneker, but he's younger, and he lived over next door to this young couple for a few months. Went over one night and claimed the husband owed him money and shot him in the doorway, and then he went in and shot his wife and went back home because the cops were interviewing the neighborhood people the night of the crime, and they interviewed the murderer, and he was like, he's like a psychopath that just didn't register, and he was arrested later for this cold-blooded murder. And then we had another lady up on Capitol Hill on New Year's Eve. She was stabbed to death. And it turns out the guy was a habitual criminal out on parole, and he was similar to Reneker. So he was a lot younger. He's in his 30s. But, I mean, to me, these guys, they don't get better. You know, to me, they're going to be always a threat. So if the authorities know where he is and can keep an eye on him, that's all. I guess that's probably pretty much all they can do. Unless he reoffends, then they can nab him and throw him in jail again.
Yeah, it sounds as if he was not convicted of a sexual offense in regards to your mother's case, at least,
right.
And because the testing that was done at the request of the Attorney General's office up there right. failed to conclude that he was a predator. It sounds like this will not be a case, as we often see here in Arizona and across the country, where neighborhoods are actually receiving flyers advising them
right.
of a level 1, 2, or 3. This sounds like
right.
this guy's going to be allowed to slip into a neighborhood, and there will be no heads up to the people who live there.
I think that's my understanding, because you're right. He didn't qualify for category 1, 2, or 3, so he is, yeah, they won't be able to publish a name and a picture like on the television or on the local or the neighborhood telephone pole or anything. You know, I think he's going to be anonymous.
Did he ever admit that he had intended to rape your mother?
Yes, he did, finally. Because the review board asked him, did you rape Mrs. Stubberfield? And he said no. And then they said, was your intent to rape her? And he said yes. And that's when he admitted that she put up a fight and he killed her. He's a very, one of his, one of his patterns is he goes into a rage. He went into a rage and killed her. Because she refused to be raped. You know, she fought his rape attempt.
And does that fit everything you knew about your mother in terms of fighting and not just caving in, so to speak?
I think she was pretty well reserved to the fact that here I am 3 hours and miles away from my home. And I'm, you know, it's one of those things, I'm going to die anyway, and I'm going to just fight to the end. I mean, I myself could put myself in that situation where it's pretty hopeless by then. And I'm going to fight this guy to the end and just, you know, there was really no way out for her at that point.
Right now, we don't know if Reneker actually walked out of prison as he was scheduled to do yesterday. Will you be given any sort of a heads up or a confirmation that he has been released?
As far as I know, I won't. We did get a note from the state about 2 weeks ago saying that he is scheduled to be released on January 20th with the intent, two things, with the intent to move to Arizona and after he is reviewed for a last-ditch effort to see if he qualifies for sexual predator, which came back negative. So I don't know if I'll get notified any further. I don't think I will. I think that's pretty much it.
But the letter did, just 2 weeks ago, mention that he, Reneker, plans to move to the state of Arizona.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it's a sad irony, but he walks out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
As you are a 52-year-old man now, your mother died at 52.
That's right. I know, it is ironic, yeah. And I feel pretty young. You know, it's funny how I kind of thought, I was talking to a reporter the other day, and I said, you know, 61, that's kind of old. And then we both looked at each other, and we go, no, it's not very old. And, you know, at 52, I feel great, you know. Mm-hmm. So Reneker at 61, even though he's supposedly full of cancer, you know, he's still very capable of harming people. So that's the sad thing. If he would just die of cancer, this whole thing would be over, at least for him, at least for us and my family and him. And nobody else. I wouldn't have to worry that he would harm anybody else.
Do you actually ever consider the fact that he may be somewhere where you are, around your home, out in public?
You know, I'm aware of the fact. For me personally, I'm not worried, but, you know, for my wife and my son and my daughters and my sister and her kids and stuff, you know, it's something that I can't control, even though I'm aware of it. You know, it's kind of a catch-22. You know, you can't be everywhere at once, and you don't want to be a prisoner in your own house. We do have to move on and live our lives. So in the back of our minds, it's there, but it's not something I'm going to dwell on because I just hope the cancer gets him soon. And even though, you know, there's a good chance I'll never know when he dies. I'll never be notified because I don't know where he is. But I'm just hoping that the cancer gets him soon, and then nobody will have to worry about it.
Very good. You have been a great interview. Thank you so much.
One of the questions by you and the Yakima reporter and some of the Seattle reporters that have talked to me, this Arizona thing comes up a lot, and they go, are you relieved that he's moving to Arizona? And I said, I'm not relieved that he's moving to Arizona. If it turns out, he's very manipulative, and I don't believe a word he says. But to me, if he moved around the corner or if he moved to Arizona, it doesn't matter to me. He's still, in my mind, a huge danger to the community, and he needs to be watched, and people need to be aware of him. He doesn't deserve to be anonymous. He needs to be labeled as a dangerous man, and I don't care where he is. So it is nice that people in Arizona are going to be, some of them, or whatever you can do to get the word out, that he is maybe going to be down there.
Mr. Stubberfield, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. No problem.
And that'll do it for this edition of Beyond90Seconds.com. A special thanks to our guest, Scott Stubberfield. For more information about this case, surf over to your favorite search engine and look for the January 20th article written by reporter Chris Bristol of the Yakima Herald Republic. Shorter versions of Bristol's story appeared elsewhere, including the Seattle Times. For now, this is Mark Horner saying thank you for listening to Beyond90Seconds.com. Trip! If you'd like to learn more about the band Wound Too Tight, you can do so by visiting myspace.com/WoundTooTight. By the way, Wound Too Tight is WOUND, 2, TIGHT.